Good morning. You know it as a cultural venue, but once Honolulu's Blaisdell Center was a war memorial. Today it'll be rededicated thanks to one woman. Tanya Harrison returns to the show to tell us the rest of the story in a few minutes. Meanwhile, the saga of climate change countermoves continues in Paris next week. Neil Conan gives us a preview. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The pressure to build in Hawaii can leave our legacy by the wayside if we're not careful. And the Historic Hawaii Foundation has compiled a list of the most endangered historic places of 2015. We'll hear from Executive Director Kirsten Faulkner. And looking at the Maui years of the father of modern China, Dr. Sun Yat-sen, with Busaba Yip Douglas of the Sun Yat-sen Foundation for Peace and Education.
That's the conversation for Tuesday, November 10th. Now, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
A lot of conversations about history today.
A lot of conversations about history and a little bit of musical history just there a moment ago. And the loss of Alan Toussaint.
Sad loss, very much.
Very much so. But we're going to talk about, again, first thing this morning. Now, in 1964, the plaque read, Honolulu International Center, dedicated to all the sons and daughters of Hawaii who serve their country in time of war, and in special tribute to those who gave their lives in order that freedom and justice might prevail throughout the world. That plaque, marking the complex later renamed for Honolulu Mayor Neil Blaisdell, disappeared over the years. In 2010, one woman uncovered its history and has been spearheading the rededication of the center. That happens later today, thanks to Tanya Harrison, who joins us now. Welcome back. Good to talk to you again.
Good to be here. Thank you.
You've been on quite a journey with this for the last 5 years, but the last time that we talked, you had been amassing what seemed to be a timeline of what happened with the war memorial and asking people for their remembrances and for any of their memorabilia, and they sent things to you.
Yes, people have been sharing items from the Blaisdell's history, not just the war memorial aspect, but its history in general. I have several postcards from the 60s and tickets and various memorabilia. But a few people do remember portions of the war memorial aspect of its history. Just yesterday, I learned of a gentleman who was a McKinley High School student in the late 60s, and he recalls the original war memorial plaque on a boulder but on the corner of King and Ward by the concert hall. And the plaque was originally dedicated by the arena, and so if his memory is correct, that means it was moved. But we think it was lost by 1970. So that's the first recollection from anyone who
recalls. And that happened just yesterday.
Just yesterday I learned of that, yes. So this is still, I'm still researching this.
And people are still helping you fill in details. Meanwhile, though, this story of how this happened, because most people don't know it is the Honolulu International Center, anybody who grew up in the late 70s, 80s knew it as the Blaisdell Center. But so give us a little bit of that timeline history from the early parts of the 60s and in 62, 63 when this project came to be.
So the Blaisdell was originally they referred to it as the Honolulu's War Memorial Municipal Auditorium before they named it the HIC. And originally, the arena was the original War Memorial Auditorium, but the complex was built as two separate projects, the arena and exhibition hall, and then the concert hall broke ground at separate times. And people fought over it for a good year about what to name the complex. And so the word memorial never ended up in the name for whatever reason. And so it was dedicated as a memorial in 64. And the only way we knew it was a memorial was because of the plaque that essentially served as the Blaisdell's name tag, telling us, yes, this place is Honolulu's War Memorial Auditorium. And it was dedicated in 1964, And we don't know why the plaque disappeared, but once that plaque was gone, there was nothing to tell us it was a memorial at all. And so with this new rededication, the Blaisdell's essentially getting its name tag back with this new plaque. So
this is sort of like the great story about the Blaisdell Center that we've never heard.
Yeah, it's when they had the original dedication ceremony, there were about 1,000 people that attended. It wasn't as organized as it could have been, at least from what I've read. They were didn't have any lights. It happened after dark. The only lighting they had was from a TV camera shining the light on the plaque so people could read it. About 7,000 people attended a show in the arena. And then the next day they had a formal opening of the concert hall. And so people were a little confused. Oh, okay, the dedication the day before was just for the arena. And people were confused whether it was just the arena or the entire complex that was the war memorial. Maybe the memo didn't get around. And that could have contributed to how this was later lost. I mean, the project, when it was being planned, I mean, it almost died several times. It's amazing the place was ever constructed. And so that was the most important thing, was to get it built. And somehow along the way, the memorial aspect, was lost, and we don't know why.
The plaque itself, although you had a recollection given to you yesterday saying that, it was on the corner and not on the building itself, not the convention center part,
it was on a boulder.
It was on a boulder,
yeah.
No, but originally it hadn't been. It was on the building, right? It was on not the concert hall part, right?
Oh, well, the memorial plaque was originally on a boulder. It was a bronze plaque on a boulder, but because the arena and concert hall were built as two separate projects, Mayor Blaisdell wanted people to think of it as one, and he asked for two identical dedicatory plaques, one on the wall of the concert hall and one on the wall of the arena. And the original diagrams of those plaques have since been purged, so I don't know what they looked like. But today, if you go to the Blaisdell, you'll see two identical plaques, one on that wall of the arena. If you enter the building, it's right on the right, so you have to go through the gate first. But you can see it from the other side of the fish ponds, and another on the Diamond Head side of the concert hall. And they say Neil S. Blaisdell Center in 1964. This probably replaced those original two dedicatory plaques. But at the time, people thought of it as two separate projects. Blaisdell referred to it as our new War Memorial Auditorium and Theater Concert Hall Complex, the Honolulu International Center. That's one reason why they gave the entire complex one name instead of the individual building separate names. They wanted people to think of it as one. It was Hawaii's first convention center.
So if both of those plaques were dedicated, they both disappeared.
Those two plaques were not memorial plaques. They just had the name of the facility. The memorial plaque that dedicated it as a war memorial was out on a boulder somewhere, we think, where the current current box office is. We don't know exactly where it was. We don't have a photo, but we know where the original ceremony occurred, which was on the Eva side of the arena in the main concourse area. And it was rather small, from what I was told. So, and currently there's the box office was built in the early 90s. So any boulders in that area would have been moved. And there were also boulders placed at the Blaisdell. I forget if it was in the 60s, early 70s, from a Japanese rock garden. For all I know, they rearranged all the boulders on the campus numerous times. There's been a lot of changes there since it was first opened.
So a lot of opportunities for that original plaque dedicating it as a war memorial to have been taken away.
Right, and there were also a lot of vandalism in that area where the original war memorial dedication ceremony occurred in the 60s. There were kids were protesting concerts. They were actually protesting the fact they had to pay to go to concerts. there were a few other protests there that did a lot of damage to the grounds, and it's possible it could have been moved to protect it from vandalism. We just don't know. It's
or could have just been taken.
It could have been taken.
And it's in somebody's basement.
Yeah, that's an idea. We have no idea.
So if anybody has it, please return it. But today, there's going to be not quite a replica because you don't really know what it looks like, but at least a plaque that's going to mark the fact that it was the Honolulu International Center from 1963 to 1976. And that same phrase will be repeated again, the one about dedicating to all the sons and daughters of Hawaii as a war memorial.
Correct. And this time it's on a quite substantial pohaku. This stone was originally by the arena, and I understand it took quite effort to move it. It was rather dangerous. It's on a concrete base.
So you're not going to miss it?
Oh, no. Those of you stuck in traffic on Ward Avenue will see it between the concert hall and Ward Avenue. And So
take a look.
Take a look. It's got landscaping. And next time you go to the Blaisdell, leave a lay of aloha for our war veterans there.
Well, Tanya, it's been quite a journey, and it's not over yet because you're still piecing some of this together and telling us the rest of the story and more of it as you know. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Tanya Harrison is the founder of the Neil S. Blaisdell Center War Memorial Project. She was raised on Kauai and is a wildlife biologist. The rededication ceremony of the Blaisdell Center as the War Memorial happens later today at 5 o'clock, and it's open to the public. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:16. Coming up, more historic buildings are added to the endangered list. First, your backyard quiz.
We all know about saxophones and clarinets, but have you ever heard of a zafun? In today's backyard quiz, we're taking a look at these unique instruments and their origins here in Hawaii. Often referred to as a bamboo sax, a zafun is a type of single-reed woodwind instrument that is capable of playing a two-octave chromatic scale. The zafun's range is often compared to a European instrument called a shalumo, which is essentially an ancestor of the modern-day clarinet. So zafuns are capable of accurately playing music written for the clarinet, as well as music written for the saxophone. The origin of the instrument can be traced back more than 20 years to a musician and resident of Maui who handmade the first prototypes from bamboo he found in the forests on the eastern side of the island. To this day, he's still producing handmade as well as plastic zafuns. And for our backyard quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us his name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm David Cheever from the Hawaii Architectural Foundation. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
How much of our historic legacy is contained in the structures we build for ourselves? When a historic building is destroyed, something is lost that can't be regained, and that concern is part of what drives the Historic Hawaii Foundation every year to add to its list of Hawaii's most endangered historic places and urge the public to join in the preservation effort. Foundation Executive Director Kirsten Faulkner is with us this morning. Good morning, Kirsten.
Good morning, Chris.
And places are more than buildings in your listing, right?
Absolutely. We're looking at the full range of sites, buildings, structures, and communities that reflect the history of Hawaii. We want people to really think about the places that shape both our everyday experiences, but also the great moments in history, and think about how that shapes us as a people and as a culture.
And they don't have to be beautiful monuments either. I notice you have Quonset huts on your list this year.
I think it's important that we don't confuse things we like with things that we can learn from.
Yeah.
And historic places tell us a story. They tell us about the people, the events, the trends, the issues, the wins, the losses, the good, the bad, the ugly. Mm-hmm. And they're not always pretty. And so we can learn and be inspired by the full range of our history, not just the pretty parts.
You learn about a lot about a period just from looking at a building. As something as very clearly 1930s structure, turn of the 20th century. Just even that, the way the styles of architecture can reveal a great deal, can't they?
Those periods of history, those periods of significance are so representational of the needs of the time. And so the Quonset huts, for example, came out of World War II and the need for fast, cheap, mobile buildings because
right.
it was wartime.
Yeah.
And so that's reflected in the industrial nature of those buildings and also their adaptability, how they could be used for many, many, many purposes.
They go up quickly. It's more than a tent, but less than a building.
Exactly.
But they shelter you from the wind and the rain.
And they have a certain style all their own.
Yes.
So the Quonset huts at Pohakaloa Training Area on Hawaii Island made the list this year, and it's sort of an unusual choice. We wanted to be able to talk about that period of time and that period of building and what it meant. And looking not only at them as individual structures, but as a collective, as more than the sum of their parts.
Which was true in a lot of ways of some of your other selections as well. I mean, I'm thinking of the church on Hawaii Island that had to be moved twice to get out of the way of the lava flow.
The Star of the Sea Church, yeah. Originally from Kalapana. It's one of the two painted churches on Hawaii Island and dates from the 1930s. And you're right, when the lava flow was coming into Kalapana in 1990, this was one of the buildings that they picked up, put on a flatbed truck, took down Highway 130 and found a new home for it. And it's threatened once again, this time not by lava, but by neglect, by vandalism, by just lack of maintenance. So it needs some help. It needs some love.
Which is especially too bad because of all the efforts that went into getting it where it is now. So since it got moved, there wasn't really anyone to take care of it?
Like a lot of churches and temples and other sacred places, the congregation has dwindled over the years. And buildings especially need occupants. They need people who are in them, actively using them, regularly investing in the maintenance and the care. So neglect and vacancy is one of the biggest threats to our historic places. This particular one is a favorite of tourists. You know, it's on this main road. People can stop in, get their picture taken. It's transitioned from being more of a local church to also being a tourist destination and attraction. But with that comes challenges. You know, you need to have bathrooms for tourists. You need to have places for parking. You need to have amenities for them. And, you know, maybe that's part of the solution as well. When we bring in new constituents and new people who can contribute, then there's a partnership opportunity that could come out of that.
Which would be because if the very fact of it's becoming a tourist attraction leads to its destruction, that just sends the wrong message in every possible way, doesn't it?
There are basically two threats to historic places. One is neglect, which we've already talked about,
right.
But the other is being loved to death. When you have too many people extracting too much.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to have that appropriate balance between enough to take care of it, but not so much that it just overwhelms the site.
You know, I think of a conversation we had on the show just the other day about the Waikiki Natatorium, which is an example of pretty much everything you're talking about, including the message that's sent when you have kind of a ruin in the middle of a tourist area, right?
It sends a horrible message about what we value.
Yeah.
And the Natatorium has been on the most endangered historic places list since 2005. It was on the very first list. And every few years, we revisit it and say, yes, it's still there, but yes, it's still endangered. And the fact that this is the centennial of World War I, and that's a World War I memorial, mm-hmm. I think resonates with a lot of people. Because really, a lot of the memorials in particular, and we just talked about the Blaisdell Center as a memorial,
yeah.
but that is our embodiment of memory. And when the memories fade, when the people who lived through World War I or now World War II and even more recent events, mm-hmm. when they're no longer with us, when we no longer have that living memory, all we have is societal memory, all we have is community memory, and those places tell those stories. So when the last World War I veteran is no longer with us, when the last World War II veteran is no longer with us, those memorials take on special significance because otherwise we forget. Our memories are short.
Kirsten, I really like the way you that phrase, the embodiment of memory, because you can't just let memories exist in the cloud, to use a sort of computer term, right? It needs to be embodied. And, you know, with the natatorium reminds us that 10,000 people from Hawaii, a territory at the time, volunteered to fight in a European war. Why would you do that? I mean, it's a sign of enormous loyalty to the nation and to its causes. You know, that's a statement in itself, right?
It is. And, you know, the other amazing thing about the natatorium as a war memorial is its living aspect,
yeah.
that it was a swimming pool. It
as
was a
function.
Place as a function. It was a place of community gathering, a place of expressing life. And to live life and have a community gathering place as a way to remember what we were fighting for. And I think that was a very important part of that particular memorial. So these historic places, of course, are often very beautiful. You know, the painted church is a wonderful example. Mm-hmm. They're representational of the people and places that reflected what was happening at the time. For example, on this year's list, we have the Lihue Shell Station, which was designed by Guy Nelson Rothwell in 1930. And the Garden Island newspaper on Kauai did a front page story calling it the most handsome service station in the islands.
It really
is. And it is. And even all these years later, you can look at it and see the shape of a Hawaiian hale. You can think about a time when cars were unusual. There were, you know, only a few cars on the island of Kauai, but here's a service station to take care of them. And our needs have changed, right? But the building lives on.
Well, just seeing that as on your list really brought a smile, Kirsten. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Me too. Kirsten Faulkner is the Executive Director of the Historic Hawaii Foundation, which will present the 2015 additions to its list of Hawaii's most endangered historic places at a public event this Friday at 5:30 at the IBM Building's courtyard on Ala Moana Boulevard in Honolulu. The event will feature an overview of the threatened historic sites and discussions on how the public can help save them. And you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Knock, knock. Who's there? Obama. Obama who?
It just feels good to admire somebody.
No joke. Author Marilyn Robinson tells the story of talking one-on-one with President Obama about the future of American democracy. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
This program is brought to you with pride by the members of Hawaii Public Radio and by these community partners. Hawaii Public Radio sustaining members, Camille's Meals on Wheels, Family Promise of Hawaii, and the Independent Order of Odd Fellows, the Excelsior Lodge No. 1. Mahalo for your support during Celebration 2015. easy being a renter. First, you have to find a place and then hope that your relationship with your landlord can weather whatever happens afterward. When that's not the case, renters often call a variety of agencies and groups looking for help. And that's because in Hawaii, unlike in many other places, there isn't an organization solely dedicated to the rights of renters. Civil Beat editor Patty Epler has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So how can it be that in a place that has such a need for rentals, so many people looking for rentals and so many renters, that we don't have any sort of advocacy group that protects them?
That's such an interesting question. There used to be a landlord-tenant organization years ago, but it sort of fell apart due to infighting amongst the folks who were running it. But, you know, you're absolutely right, Beth Ann. There, most cities have some sort of tenants union, something like that, but we don't have one here. And it turns out that it's, you know, really needed, a lot of advocates are now saying.
So what happens when people are upset with their landlords and they're looking for help? Where do they go?
So, well, there's a couple places. The Office of Consumer Protection, it's a state agency, says it fields an amazing 6,000 calls a year from renters. That's about 100 calls a week from people who have questions or concerns about what's happening with their landlord. But the Office of Consumer Protection is not an advocacy agency. It really just answers questions and sends people on their way. Then you have like the Legal Aid Society, which, you know, does provide legal representation, but they have a super small budget, and they get dozens of calls a week as well. So it's kind of scattered, really.
Where does that leave us now? Is there any sort of movement to create a new renters union?
As far as we can tell, there is not. There are only people who say one is desperately needed, and if only we could find someone who had the money to support it or who could put together a new nonprofit with a board of directors with some sort of energy and passion around this, that would be great. But as near as we can tell, there is no one that's actually picking up the ball and running with that. The other thing is that these landlord-tenant advocacy groups could also testify on legislation, and there's plenty of housing and, you know, those kinds of bills running through the legislature, but really it's kind of the Board of Realtors that goes in and advocates for the landlord, and the Office of Consumer Protection is limited in what it can do, but it will go in and advocate on the tenant side a little bit. So there's kind of a need for it, really.
And the gap there that none of these organizations can fill by becoming that union, that tenants union?
So the Legal Aid Society told us that their funding source, which is largely federal, puts some restrictions on what they can and can't do. So they need to be invited to testify at the legislature. And as you might imagine, the legislature doesn't really invite them to testify all that often. So that's kind of where we're left. There's also the question of whether homelessness is in part caused by not having good advocates on the tenant side of the coin.
All good questions, and obviously now not with an answer to who may step into that gap. We'll see if anyone takes that up. Certainly is a need. Thanks, Patty.
Maybe they'll listen to this show and decide to do it.
Well, you know, it's going to take somebody, or we'll be talking about this years to come. Thanks, Patty.
Exactly. Thanks. Bye.
Patty Epler is the editor of Civil Beat.
Support for The Conversation comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Hi, good morning. I'm Brian Watanabe from Pacific New Media. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
At the end of this month, nations from around the world will gather in Paris to address the difficult issues raised by climate change. While every part of the planet is affected by the global increase in temperature, some Pacific Island nations fear that they'll be uninhabitable by the end of this century as sea level rises. So the issue is especially critical for our region. News analyst Neil Conan will be in Paris to cover the conference in his Pacific News Minutes and in conversations with us. But for now, he's on the line from his Macnut farm on the Big Island, as he is most Tuesdays. Good morning. And how's your French?
Bonjour, Beth Ann.
Bonjour.
It's been a long time since high school, but I'm not completely lost as long as we stay in the present tense.
Well, speaking of the present tense, for a long time, the effects of climate change seemed like something in the distant future, but we really know it's here and now.
Absolutely. Ocean levels rise as the water warms and the ice caps melt. Warmer water fuels more and more powerful storms. Weather patterns shift, so some places are wetter and others, California suffers drought.
These United Nations conferences on climate change haven't always gone well. I mean, thinking back to how the United States rejected the protocols adopted in Kyoto, the follow-up meeting in Copenhagen is pretty much widely regarded as a failure. So what do you think the prospects are for Paris?
Improved, but it's far from clear that it's going to be enough. There have been any number of meetings to prepare for Paris, and there's been a major change in the method of how this conference is going to operate. The previous approach was very much top-down. We set a worldwide goal and then established limits on each country's carbon emissions to reach that goal. Now, this failed for any number of reasons, to name just one. Big developing countries like China and India said they should be exempt while they work to bring their people out of poverty, while big developed countries like the United States then said, well, why do we have to accept limits to hurt our economies when major polluters like India and China don't have to do anything?
Okay, so you mentioned a difference that might be happening this time. What would it be?
Well, each country has been asked to come up with a plan of its own. There's still a global goal. The issues of developing countries versus the developed countries haven't gone away by any means. But this is more bottom-up, so it feels less like limits are being imposed by this, distant international meeting. And two other things have changed as well. I mentioned all the meetings in the run-up to Paris. None was more important than the summit meeting last year between President Obama and President Xi Jinping of China, when China agreed for the first time to set a date by which it will cap carbon emissions. It now looks like it may stop increasing its carbon output before 2035, but as its economy is slowing down a little bit, and whether that's enough is going to be a big question. But at that agreement, for the first time, puts China, a major player, in the game for the first time.
You just mentioned two factors. What's the other one?
The other one, I think, is time. Things have gotten worse, measurably worse. The data matches the models the scientists projected, and we passed a couple of milestones, I guess. Carbon now regularly makes up more than 400 parts per million of the atmosphere. That's a measurement taken up at Mauna Loa, by the way. It's a real tipping point for climate change. Just yesterday, the Met, the Meteorological Office in Britain, published an estimate that the Earth has now warmed by 1 degree Celsius since the start of the Industrial Revolution. In other words, since human activity started to change the climate. That can fluctuate. 2015 looks set to be the warmest year on record. 2016 might be cooler, so you go down below that one degree, but the trend is unmistakable.
Now, the goal is to limit global warming to less than 2 degrees Celsius. Do the plans that the U.S. and other countries have come up with, do they meet that goal?
No, they don't. The estimate, and you have to emphasize here, particularly this is an estimate, there's a big fudge factor here. But the estimate is that if everybody holds strictly to the plans that they've submitted to the UN, the world would warm something like 2.5 degrees Celsius by the end of this century.
Half a degree here or there doesn't sound like much, but that's not the case, is it?
No, it has huge effects. You're absolutely right. The enormous ice sheets on top of Greenland and Antarctica are melting from the inside out. More and more of that ice is going to slide into the ocean. Water already expands as it warms anyway. That ice adds to it. You see places like Kiribati in the Marshall Islands, countries where the highest elevation is 9 or 10 feet above sea level. Kiribati says whatever agreement comes out in Paris is going to come too late for them. Their islands are going to be underwater by the end of the century, no matter what. Other island states say they will go under unless the world holds the increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius and makes that legally binding.
So you really see how this is going to affect people in the area. Neighbors who live in low-lying atolls, people have been coming to Hawaii because of that. What about volcanic islands like Hawaii, though?
Well, just look at the topography. Most people tend to live in low-lying areas near the water. So any problems you may have now with sewer systems and storm drainage and tidal flooding, I know Honolulu never has any of that, all of that's going to get worse. Warm water has bleached a lot of the coral on our reefs this summer. That's 30% in some places. Now, that's El Nino as well, but scientists believe that these patterns play into each other. The generally warmer water makes the El Nino both longer and more powerful.
I want to take you back to something you said also a moment ago, that legally, you know, this could be legally binding. If there is an agreement in Paris, how is this going to be enforced?
Oh, that's a good question. There is no global authority to do this. There's no, international climate court. Each country is going to be asked to commit to make its part of the deal legally binding on itself. And you immediately see major problems. In this country, for example, is a Republican-controlled Congress going to embrace a deal negotiated by President Obama that they say will be a job killer? And now that's just the United States. And even if countries do commit, what happens the next time there's an economic downturn and they decide that they need to juice up the economy? What happens in the next change of government?
Okay, but this is a whole lot bigger than just low-lying Pacific islands. Well, of course, they're the most dramatically affected. What do they want, and what are they going to hope for as you go to find this out when you go to Paris?
Absolutely. We're going to talk a lot about this once we get to Paris. But what they've said individually and through organizations like the Association of Small Island States, that in addition to lowering the goal to 1.5 degrees Celsius, they need money to help them adapt. A lot of atolls, for example, as one side of an island erodes, the ocean will deposit sand on the other side, so you might have the same amount of land, but it's suddenly in a different place. They need help with agriculture as soil becomes contaminated with salt. Eventually, some are going to need a new place to live. So are rich countries like Australia and New Zealand and the United States and Japan, are they going to accept people as climate migrants? What happens to the language and culture of those islands when a nation is forced to relocate its people? Do they all live in the same place anymore? Do you retain your nationality if your nation sinks beneath the waves? Does that nation still have fishing and mineral rights in its territorial waters if it's underwater? Does it still have a seat in the United Nations? Is it still a nation? All of these are really major questions that remain unanswered.
And then we'll see what attempts at getting some answers to that you'll bring back for us after you go to Paris. But we're going to try to talk to you while you're there. Won't be next week because you'll be in transit. And so have a good and safe trip, and we'll talk to you the next time we can.
Bienvenue.
And also have a really wonderful and safe trip, too. Take care, Neil.
We'll see you, Bethany.
Neil Conant is a regular contributor to HPR with the Pacific News Minute. It's part of his ongoing radio career, now originating from his Hawaii Island macadamia farm and from Paris in the next week or two. Now we're going to get back to the backyard quiz. We told you this morning about a unique instrument that was invented in Hawaii more than 20 years ago. The zafun sounds like a cross between a clarinet and a saxophone. Sometimes it's called a bamboo sax, and the zafun has a single reed. And it's a woodwind instrument capable of playing a two-octave fully chromatic scale. Now, some who have heard of Zafoon's range of sound compare it with an older clarinet like a European instrument called a shalomo. So players have found it pretty simple to use to perform music written for the clarinet. Even musically inclined former U.S. President Bill Clinton got a kick out of a Zafoon at the 2007 TED conference. And as mentioned, the instrument was brought to life by a Maui resident. And for this morning's backyard quiz, we asked you to tell us his name. It is Brian Whitman.
And Beth Ann, Samuel Charles in Kahului knew the answer and added that he actually met Brian 20 years ago when he moved to the islands and describes him as a great, talented guy. Thanks for that, Samuel, and you'll be getting a T-shirt. That's today's quiz. If you have one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com.
Dr. Sun Yat-sen brought dreams of freedom to a turn-of-the-century China that was still dominated by centuries of dynastic rule. Those dreams were fed in Hawaii, where he was educated and where he sought refuge when his efforts to build a free nation in China made him a wanted man there. He's being remembered this weekend in Lahaina, and Dr. Busaba Yip Douglas of the Woh-Hing Society in Lahaina is on the line to share some history with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a very important legacy, and not everyone understands the role that Hawaii played in it, yeah?
Yes.
So yeah. what was the role of Hawaii in Dr. Sun's life?
Actually, the islands of Hawaii and Maui and the Big Island, too, play important roles in the history of Sun Yat-sen and his family. During the revolution that he ended the Manchu Qing Dynasty and start the Republic of China in 1911.
He was educated here
at
Iolani and what was then called Oahu College, right?
Yes.
And he had family on Maui as well.
Yeah, his elder brother Sun Mei, actually he was the silent hero behind Sun Yat-sen's accomplishment. We like to honor him, this great man, together with all the Chinese and non-Chinese who stand side by side to protect him when he came to Hawaii and Maui after he started the first uprising in Canton and it failed. There was no home for him. So he and his family moved to Hawaii and live on Maui. And his brother owned a big ranch, 3,900-acre ranch, in Keokia, or Kula Chinatown. That's the home provided for Sun Yat-sen and his family. And his brother lived here for 25 years on Maui, actually.
And his brother was very prosperous, right?
Yes, he came, Chris, you know, he came when he was really poor, no money at all.
Mm-hmm.
10 years in Honolulu. He was a great man. He worked so hard, saved money, and helping other Chinese. And after 10 years, he moved to Maui and opened a store in Kahului. And after 25 years, he was named as the King of Maui because he owned 3,900-acre ranch in Keokia.
This is Dr. Sun's brother.
Elder brother, 12 years elder brother. And he's the one together with the Chinese sent money to support the revolution. There were 10 uprisings failed in China before the 1911 revolution.
And yet, in spite of that, Dr. Sun is hailed as the father of the country by both the Republic of China and mainland China, right?
Exactly.
Which is kind of amazing because those two countries are sworn enemies.
You know why?
Tell me.
Because Sun Yat-sen was a great man. He was a great leader, has a big vision, and he devoted all his life for the cause of China. His love for motherland is incredible. I recall when I was young, my parents always mentioned about hardship in China. There was no hope for future generations. This great man stand up to end the Manchu Qing dynasty and bring the hope for future generations.
Because
that's why he has a big dream, not only for China, for the whole world come closer as one family, or the universal peace, love, and global harmony.
Well, you know, I can't help think that living in America was part of his inspiration, because just as America inspired the French Revolution, the fact of this country as really the first country to successfully throw off colonial overlords, it had to have served as an example, don't you think?
Yes. And you know why he was a great man? Because he lived his life, and we all Chinese like to support his dream, because when he passed away, he said the work of the revolution still not get done. He left a heartfelt message to the people in China and the world to continue his dream.
Don't you think that that work still remains undone, don't you think?
My personal feeling, I have trust and hope. It proves in the world today, researching for what is the meaning of the development, the modernization, and it happened in mainland China now and in Taiwan. They follow the teaching of Sun Yat-sen called the Three Principles of the People. And Sun Yat-sen already present. Actually, he traveled all over the world. He studied both the East and the West.
Well, let's hope that his example can carry forward. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Yes, thank you so much for chatting. Please come to the Sun Yat-sen event that we will have this weekend.
We'll send
Saturday.
People your way. Thank you.
For Friday and Saturday, a celebration to honor and celebrate the remembering Sun Yat-sen and the history and the connection to Hawaii
thank you.
And Maui.
Dr. Busaba Yip Douglas is the cultural director of the Woheng Museum and Woheng Society in Lahaina, which is holding a two-day celebration of the life of Dr. Sun Yat-sen this Friday and Saturday at the Woheng Museum in Lahaina, Maui. It's free, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
If the piano vibraphone duets of Chick Corea and Gary Burton transport you to another space, you'll want to find yourself in the Atherton Studio on November 21st for the McKay-James Duo. Thomas McKay and Tommy James treat you to their own vibe and piano improvisations, Saturday, November 21st at 7:30 p.m. Go to hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
We had a lot of history in today's show.
We did. No struggle thinking of what the theme was of this morning's program. Sometimes it falls together that way, right?
Sometimes it just happens. Sometimes it gets a little bit of a nudge. But looking at some of the buildings that are trying to be saved and safeguarded for future, and also the story of the Blaisdell Center that most of us never even knew until Tanya Harrison started to dig around because she was just interested.
That's right. And you know, the whole idea that when we create something as a memorial, you don't let that go by. Memorials are always planned to be permanent memorials.
Unless plaques are lost and you have to go dig up the story again.
Exactly.
Well, we'll see the new plaque installed later today at 5 o'clock at the Blaisdell Center. It's open to the public. If you want to go, you can go and do that too. That's it for today. Up tomorrow. It is Veterans Day, and how fast are Hawaii's veterans getting care now? Dr. James Spira returns to the show with an update.
And we'll look at the legacy, ongoing legacy of Glenn Miller and his band. And if you have something to say about anything you hear on the show, you can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any part of the show or you just want to hear something again, you can find it on the HPR2 archive. Links to information about guests and topics are there too. All you have to do is look under talk shows for the conversation on HPR2.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you back here in the morning for more of the conversation.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin.
As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned, concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling? The wind and the wires made a tattletale sound, and the wave broke over the railing. And every man knew, as the captain did too, 'twas the witch of November come stealing. The dawn came late and the breakfast had to wait, when the gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain in the face of a hurricane west wind. Time came, the old cook came on deck saying, fellas, it's too rough to feed you. At 7 p.m. a main hatchway gave in. He said, fellas, it's been good to know you. The captain wired in, he had water coming in, and the good ship and crew was in peril. Later that night when his lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours? The searchers all say they'd have made Whitefish Bay if they'd put 15 more miles behind her. They might have split up or they might have capsized. They may have broke deep and took water. And all that remains is the faces and the names of the wives and the sons and the daughters. Lake Huron rolls, Superior sings in the rooms of her ice water mansion. Old Michigan steams like a young man's dreams. The islands and bays are for sportsmen. And farther below, Lake Ontario takes in what Lake Erie can send her. And the iron boats go, as the mariners all know, with the gales of November remembered. In a musty old hall in Detroit, they prayed in the Maritime Sailors' Cathedral. The church bell chimed till it rang 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. And the legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Superior, they said, never gives up or dead when the gales of November come early.